And yeah, we've got an interview lined up in a few minutes. We're going to be speaking with Madeline Beccaro. She wrote a book about Yoko Ono. And it's really a really interesting thing to know that, you know, Yoko is not as evil as you think she is. You know, a lot of people disagree, and there's always, you know, a lot of things that they say about her. But, as time goes on, I have a lot more respect for her. And with Madeline, we'll be able to shed some light about Yoko Ono. Well, let's play a little bit more music, and then after that, we will get her on the air, and we'll talk and get it situated. But first, I want to play a song from a band, Typhoid Mary. Yeah, take a look at them. They are just absolutely great. Well, I have a special guest in our studio. We have Madeline Beccaro. She wrote a book about Yoko Ono called In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. And as I said before, the show, or before the song, was that I think, you know, as time goes on, I've developed a great appreciation for her. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Madeline.
Thanks so much, Jennifer.
So, what is your connection with Yoko Ono? I just was curious, just trying to understand, because, you know, not all of us have a personal relationship with, you know, our subject. So, what is your connection with Ms. Ono?
So I had been a big fan of her since I was very young. I was about 10 years old when I saw a picture of her in a magazine in front of one of her films. And I just loved the whole idea of what she was doing and the innocence of it and the childlike nature of it. And when I collected everything I could ever find on her. And when I became a little older, I started writing to her. And she would write back because she understood that I really loved her for her, and I wasn't a John Lennon fan or Beatle fan, and she was so happy to, like, talk to me about her work. And then later on, a friend convinced me to go with her to the Dakota and wait outside on Yoko's birthday, and that's when I finally met her, and she started inviting me to her exhibitions and her concerts and all, so I had, you know, a really good little rapport with her.
Wow, that is so special. It's a lot of times you hear the expression "don't meet your heroes," but it sounds like you met your hero, and that is just that's really nice to hear. It really is. It's a beautiful thing. That's really really awesome. Now the other question I had was, is there something about her that nobody knows? I mean, we all, like you and I mentioned a couple weeks ago when we were getting ready for this interview, a lot of times she gets a bum rap for being the ones that broke up the Beatles. And we know for a fact that's not even close to the truth. But what are things about her that, you know, that people would be amazed at, that they'd be like, wow, Yoko Ono, really? Who knew? I mean, is there a fun fact that you can share with us about her?
Well, she's basically a humanitarian. I mean, people should know that from all her promotion of peace and love, but even more than that, she's about healing people. She went through a really rough time all throughout her life. Through her childhood, she was sheltered during the war, starving, searching for food for her brother and sister, to coming to being a woman and being ostracized for breaking up the Beatles, which she didn't even do. People were jealous that she married John Lennon. And, you know, John and Yoko really saved each other. They were both damaged souls. And they were all about healing each other and healing the world. So she's basically, you know, a humanitarian. She's trying to show us our misplaced values and trying to teach us that we have an inner power that we're really not using. She was way, way ahead of her time.
Yeah, I didn't realize this. So she turned 91 this year, and I didn't realize that she was that much older than John. Probably, what, 5 or 8 years? I don't know.
There was, 8 years.
How many years?
Eight years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it, like you mentioned about how when she had to survive during World War II, I mean, that gave me such a different appreciation for her. You know, I've had family members that, you know, have survived World War II and the Hungarian Revolution. And so I totally understand that just to see war up front, people don't understand. This isn't just a movie. This isn't some little blip on a screen. It's real, and it affects you throughout your whole life. And you learn to fight your battles in a very different way. You fight for what's important. And for her, obviously, she fought for the humanity of things and the peace that she did not see growing up. So I like I said, I have a really great appreciation for that. Now, she came here to Wesleyan at one point. I think you mentioned that in your book. Did you want to talk a little bit about the Wesleyan connection?
Sure. She did a lecture there in January of 1966, and it was titled Avant-Garde in Japan. And she staged some of her events there. But why it became important is because she felt that her events had been misunderstood. So she later wrote an essay, and it was titled To the Wesleyan People. And it was included in the catalog of her very first London exhibition where she met John Lennon. And the catalog kind of states her little mission statement. But the funny thing about it is that the text is missing three important words. And I have a copy of the signed catalog in my collection. Mm-hmm. And the missing words in the sentence were in your mind. And that's how I got the title of my book. And the sentence was, I think it's possible to see a chair as it is, but when you burn the chair, you suddenly realize that the chair in your mind did not burn or disappear. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis of all her work, that how strong and how powerful your mind is, that you can destroy something physically, but it's still there in your mind.
Yeah, it's funny. I think they talk about that a lot. You hear a lot of times that depending on certain smells or certain colors, certain, like you said, certain sensory things will trigger certain generations. You know, like maybe an older generation may remember the smell of paste, whereas, I mean, I'm a child of the 70s, so for me, it's Play-Doh. Sorry, guys, but I love the smell of Play-Doh. I don't know what they put in it, but darn, it smelled so good. But I mean, it's
the Elmer's glue, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I think she tapped into that, and we don't realize, you know, sometimes she's like the butt of bad jokes, but I think, you know, she has a way of nudging you in a manner that you don't expect. You know, you just,
right.
You know.
She wants you to dispense with all your perceptions and seek out the meaning for yourself, and also to just, you know, just everything she does is in another dimension. She sees infinite universes. She sees 5 dimensions, 6 dimensions, 7 dimensions. She's way out there, and she's trying to kind of teach us that there's so much more to the world, and especially in the subconscious.
That's really a great takeaway. Now, so interestingly enough, so she was presenting a letter in London at an art show that was related to Wesleyan. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, it was a letter to the Wesleyan people, and it was sort of a mission statement about her work, explaining it because she felt that it was misunderstood during her lecture there.
Okay.
And it just became part of her catalog, and it's kind of a little popular piece that she wrote.
Yeah, see, that was what always amazed me. Like, it wasn't until I saw a little bit more about your book, I went, oh my gosh, she was here. Like, I live here in Middletown. I live literally walking distance to the campus, and I'm like, wow. She was here. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
Before I was born, but it is. There's a real... It's a really bizarre feeling when you feel like you realize how many people have walked this campus and have been, you know, important. I mean, gosh, I mean, even Woodrow Wilson was the president of this college. So I'm always amazed about, you know, local history when people disparage Connecticut and say nothing really good happens here. I'm like, really? this is cool stuff. So her and John met in London. What did she ever get into about her relationship with John with you, or was that something that she kept pretty quiet?
Oh, she didn't have to get into it with me. John and Yoko were very open and honest and public. Every day they were spewing, you know, truths, whether it was political truths or truths about themselves, even personal, very, very personal truths. And yet, they were totally misunderstood by so many people. Their words were twisted, and I don't understand. I mean, they were just teaching all good things, all positivity, despite everything that was thrown back at them. You know, they were always radiating positivity, and there's nothing hidden. It's just that people choose to believe what they want to. So, you know, she met John in London at her exhibition. He was really enthralled by her work because it was so different and so simple and positive and wonderful. And they were both previously married with small children, so they kind of didn't even get together for 18 months because they knew this was going to be some heavy trip.
Right, right. Now, she had children from a previous marriage. How many kids did she have with her previous
husband? She had one daughter, Kyoko, and he had a son, Julian.
And if I remember, Julian is probably, what, in his early to mid-60s now? I don't remember. I know he's a twee older than me, but enough.
He's a little younger than me. Yeah, early 60s, I would say.
Yeah. How old is Yoko's daughter, would you say? Because I don't know much about her.
Oh, God. She was born in probably 50. She's a little younger than me, so she's probably 60 now, too. I mean,
okay.
We're all up there.
Okay, so she and Julian actually were pretty close in age then as stepchildren, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to meet those two children, or it was just specific?
I haven't met them, but Kyoko does have my book, so I'm really thrilled that she, you know, because even her own daughter wouldn't know all this information about Yoko. You know, I really went into a lot of detail. It's 550 pages, and it's not just for the sake of detail. It's just everything is so important, and everything connects in such an amazing way. You know, and I'm illuminating this time of the 60s and 70s where things were just so different and there was so much happening. So I'm so glad that, you know, and her son Sean, you know, John and Yoko's mm-hmm. son Sean is really supportive of the book. He loves it. So that's all that matters to me, really.
That's great. Have you been able to talk to other members of the Beatles? Was it Paul and Ringo a little bit about it, or you haven't had a chance?
Paul has it. I sent it to his office when I was in London, and I don't really expect to hear much back from him. He's not, you know, he's not very public about saying nice things about Yoko, but sometimes he does. But Olivia Harrison, George's wife, recommended it on Instagram. She loved it. Patty Boyd has it, George's other wife.
Mm-hmm.
And Ringo, I'm supposed to be giving it to him this fall when he plays in New York. So that'll be cool. He was very close to Yoko. He totally loved her, appreciates her. He visited her every time he was in New York City. So, you know, everybody has their perception, but it was a lot of love.
You know, it's good to hear that because, again, as we mentioned, you know, she gets a bad rap. It sounds like, to me, I mean, Paul probably will never give an opinion per se, but he...
Mm-hmm.
He probably had a certain, my opinion is this, he probably had a certain amount of respect for John. I mean, it was his bandmate, so maybe they disagreed, but I think when you have a core vision of music like they did, even if you had a disagreement, you knew at the end of the day it was to produce good music, whatever it be. And I wouldn't be surprised in his heart. I'd like to think that there's not there might be some... There's got to be a little bit of love for John. I mean, they were together for how many years? They grew up with each other. They played music together.
Oh, there was so much love, but they just had a very complicated relationship, and they were both stubborn, and they were very competitive, you know. But, you know, they were softening towards the end there. They were really, I don't know if they were going to do music together, but they were getting closer, and right before John was killed. It was a very, very sad thing. But, you know, of course, Yoko and Paul have so much in common. They were the closest people to John in his life. So,
well, at least it makes me feel like knowing that, you know, there wasn't this extreme hatred for each other. I mean, you know, because again, anytime you follow musicians, whether you put a husband or a wife, you put a spouse involved, and all of a sudden it's like, oh God, it just puts a monkey wrench into everything. I don't care what music scene you're in. There's always the dreaded spouse putting their two cents in. But it's nice to see that, you know, at least there wasn't as much animosity as we thought there was, which I think is pretty pleasant to hear. Because, again, I hate hearing that. Because, I mean, no band is perfect. But it's nice to hear that at least they had some kind of respect for each other, even when John passed suddenly. I always find his death always kind of jarring because... Even though I was a young person, my mom was a big Beatles fan, so when she and I in the early 90s sat down and watched the documentary on them, I sat with her and I said, I cannot believe if it wasn't for the video footage, I'd never believe this band was as popular as they were. Like, how did these guys even breathe? It's just mind-boggling. And here it is, 1980. At that stage in his life, he was able to walk the streets. I mean, yeah, people recognized him, but it wasn't the level of people jamming to see him, whereas 10-15 years earlier he couldn't even tie his shoes without looking up and seeing 20,000 fans in his face. You know, it was such a such a twist of fate of, you know, just the way everything happened. And I just wouldn't want to put myself in her shoes. I couldn't imagine that. So just to let my listeners know, where can they find your book and who's publishing it? I didn't have that down.
Okay, so it's published by Conceptual Books. And if you go to conceptualbooks.com, there's the soft cover and the hard cover, and it's available to be signed by me there. But if you don't want it signed, or if you're international and you want to get better shipping costs, it's on Amazon.
Okay, well, that is great to know. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, and good luck with your book. This has been really enlightening.
I'll give you the website, too. It's inyourmindbook.com. People can review there and see interviews I've done and all kinds of stuff there.
Okay, so that's inyourmind.com.
No, inyourmindbook.com.
Inyourmindbook.com.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Madeline, for sharing your time with us. I really appreciate it, and I hope we can chat soon. And, folks, she does a really good blog on music. Let me tell you, love it, love it, love it. I was born 15 years too late. I'm telling you, I just, oh, God. The music that came out.
Yeah, the website to that one is madelinex.com, madelinex.com.
Cool. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. Have a happy Sunday. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
All right. Take care now. Okay.